meeting will come to order, and we do have a quorum. And fortunately, Representative Fitzsimmons came very early this morning, and I noted that he has carefully been reading the minutes and and so I believe he's ready to move both the minutes of January 22nd and 24th.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move both minutes. Thank you.
Any additions, corrections? Nothing. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Well, this morning we are talking about the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority, and it's a program near and dear to the hearts of many, and on the tours, a little bit smelly, too. We've had some interesting visits to some of the local facilities, and this morning we're also going to talk a little bit about the complexities of it. There are very positive things they can do, and we've actually asked Representative Erdahl, because his local project is one that I routinely use in just about every speech where I talk about the economic value of infrastructure. And so I thought, if any of you don't know the story of Litchfield, that we would ask Representative Erdahl to begin.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair.
We all know it.
Yeah, we've heard it before.
Yeah.
Why did I know you two guys?
You may not know the jobs.
Now, Representative Mahoney, there are a lot of new members here that deserve the full story. So get another cup of coffee. And
Madam Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
You know, I actually put the hearing aids in today, but I think I heard you call me Representative Mullery.
No. I said Mahoney.
All right. I was wondering if you were looking to get me to vote against everything you've...
Well, I've seen your office. You're not Representative Mullery.
Representative Erdahl, I know that you have a story that Representative Mahoney, as chair of the Economic Development Committee, is going to use often also in his presentation.
I'm sure. Well, I actually will keep this brief. In 2008, First District Association... which is located in Litchfield, major dairy producer in the state, was processing 3 million pounds of milk a day. And that's pretty good. But it still wasn't enough to meet the needs of the dairies of Minnesota. We were having to send considerable milk into South Dakota because there wasn't enough processing in the state to take care of the milk produced. And so, First District wanted to expand their operation, but they were limited by the insufficient capacity of the city of Litchfield's wastewater system. A bonding request was made allowing Litchfield to expand its wastewater facility to accommodate First District's expansion. And it was a cooperative effort from the city, the county, the region, the state, and would benefit all those. This wasn't just about Litchfield. It was about the county, the region, and the entire state, in fact, the entire dairy industry. So we put in a request for $6 million for this facility. I believe we all had a tour there. I know many of the members, maybe not so many here. Raise your hands. How many went on that tour?
Better take another tour.
We maybe have. Well, that would. It's always valuable. It's always valuable to go to Litchfield and just to see.
Love Litchfield.
Yes, and Representative Davids was in First District. Took a tour of the plant there.
He bought a cheese, Madam Chair. Like a big
mouse. And after the tour, then of course we come into session, and this was we felt a very important piece of legislation, and very gratified for the work that people put into it. Representative Hausman was very good in shepherding this piece of legislation through. The Public Facilities Authority, I think, went the extra mile in helping to make this work. There was WIF funding involved. Twice we had to change state statute to make it fit what we were trying to do in Litchfield, and that was a much appreciated help from Mr. Coleman and Mr. Freeman with the PFA. The bill passed, and we also threw $7 million for Wilmer into it, and with Representative Junkie, worked together in one piece of legislation to make this work and to get it through. Governor Pawlenty, Tom Hansen, Dan McElroy were also involved in helping once we got the ball rolling here. And the result is that production increased. The expansion was made in Litchfield, and suddenly they were up to 5 million pounds of milk every day. And if you come into Litchfield from on Highway 12 from the east, when you get to the downtown region to the left, everything over there now on the other side of the railroad tracks is First District. They take about four city blocks now. But it still wasn't enough. Because of their increased capacity, they needed new lift stations to get the wastewater to the wastewater plant. Is that the mayor of Litchfield calling?
That's my senator.
Okay. Fortunately then, in the last bonding bill, the one that we did, that special session? Yeah, I think so. The one, the $40-plus million that went to deed to decide where how the money is going to be allocated, the Litchfield proposal to do lift stations for their wastewater plant ranked number one in of all the projects. And so Litchfield again received funding and are now on their way to 7 million pounds of milk a day being processed through the Litchfield First District Association dairy processing plant. And so this is just a tremendous example of benefiting, helping a rural economy to grow, helping an industry to grow in Minnesota. It's one of the things that we should do as state legislators, and it's a good example of the partnership between agencies and committees of the House and Senate, the governor's office. Again, the PFA did a tremendous job here, and it could be a lesson to us all on how we can cooperate together bipartisanly to make good things happen for the state.
And in that case, as he said, we're going to hear from Mr. Freeman some of the parameters of the program. Once in a while, they don't fit the local project, and that was one of the reasons we were motivated to do it because of this local issue. Representative Moline had one of those issues just last year, I think, where the particular local problem and the size of the problem didn't necessarily fit the parameters of the program, and you try to do it in such a way that you don't disadvantage others down the line. But
yes, Madam Chair, and if I could just comment on that and how helpful the PFA has been. And our project was also tied to economic development. Our sewer district in Chisholm was actually at full capacity, meaning that there was actually a moratorium on construction. You couldn't build any new homes or expand your business without showing that you were decreasing the water input elsewhere. And so it was really urgent that we got that sewer district upgraded, and actually serves four different communities now. It's still in the process of construction, but the PFA has been very helpful, and it was more costly than the parameters were because it serves four different communities, but that goes to sort of the collaboration and smaller communities working together too. So it's been really great for our region, and some businesses that have been hoping to expand will now be able to do so with the new sewer district. So thank you.
So with that is, yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to conclude by emphasizing how important this is to the small towns, particularly of rural Minnesota. From PFA funding and some of the things we do, the water towers, the wastewater facilities that are so important to small towns are greatly aided by. Without this type of aid, the property taxes would skyrocket in a lot of our small towns, or frankly, some would cease to exist without this type of aid.
And in a sense, this discussion sets us up for a bill that Representative McNamer may have. I'm not sure if that's one he's going forward with or not. But at any rate, so with that introduction, Jeff Freeman is the Mahoney. I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question for whomever. I'm looking on the green sheets, page one of this, and I want to have a question for Representative Moline. The project that you were talking about, is that the central Iron Range, fourth one down that's shaded, the central Iron Range SD wastewater regionalization plant?
Representative Moline, have you had an opportunity?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, I don't see where you're referring to on the spreadsheet, but it is called the Central Iron Range Sanitary Sewer District.
Thanks.
So, welcome to the committee. I don't know if this is your first time before us as Executive Director, or have you previously been here in that?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, Jeff Freeman, this is my first time as Executive Director before the committee. I know a lot of you know Terry Kuhlman, who was the executive director for many years, and I was his deputy for many of those. And Terry retired last summer, and then I was appointed to be the director. So,
and we think he's in Florida fishing or something like that. Is that right?
Pardon me?
And we think he's in Florida fishing, right?
He's in Florida. Scuba diving was his big thing, and also grandkids in Florida. So that drew him down there.
Welcome.
There is a packet, and I think Representative Mahoney has already gotten deep into the spreadsheet, but I will go through kind of quickly some of the overview and then review the spreadsheets and be happy to take any questions. The Public Facilities Authority is a multi-agency financing authority that provides infrastructure financing programs and also municipal financing expertise to enhance environmental and economic vitality of the state. We are an independent state agency governed by a board consisting of six state commissioners representing the departments of Employment and Economic Development, Management and Budget, Health, Agriculture, Transportation, and the Pollution Control Agency. Essentially, the PFA is an infrastructure bank that manages and administers three revolving loan funds and several grant programs focused on helping local governments primarily build water infrastructure and some other types of infrastructure. The PFA member agencies set the project priorities and do the technical reviews of the projects. PFA staff, we work on the financial side, doing the credit reviews, setting loan terms and conditions, servicing the loans, coordinating funding from other sources, both our own programs and other funders, and the overall fund management and program administration. And then we also work to help local governments understanding funding process, the program requirements, and their local responsibilities for the project. PFA has statutory authority to sell up to $1.5 billion in tax-exempt revenue bonds. These are AAA rated by all three rating agencies. The bonds are repaid by loan repayments and investment earnings. There's no state backing to the PFA bonds. These are totally separate from state GO bonds. Our current bonds outstanding are $1.1 billion. And the PFA has total assets of $2.3 billion. PFA receives no state general funds for program administration. All of our admin funds come from fees on the loan repayments, a small amount of set-aside funds from the federal dollars that we receive. And in total, the PFA admin expenses are about 1% of the funding that we provide. We have eight FTEs. We get some support services from DEED. We also, through interagency agreements, provide money to the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department for their technical responsibilities in administering the programs. On the back side of the first page is a little org chart that shows the agencies and departments that make up the PFA board and their various responsibilities and connections to our different programs. Late yesterday, I realized I had neglected to update my PFA chairs and the deed commissioner's name, which is Katie Clark Sieben. So that change has already been made. I apologize for that to you and to her. The next page then gives a summary of the various PFA programs. And on the front side of this page, these are all of our clean water programs, which are primarily wastewater treatment infrastructure and some stormwater infrastructure when the project is related to infiltration and water quality issues. You can see the top bullet there, the Clean Water Revolving Fund is our largest program. This is the revolving fund loan program that provides the majority of the funding that we do. You can see the total loans to date, about $2.5 billion. We track interest savings, which is about $612 million on those loans. The program equity is provided through federal capitalization grants and a 20% state match, and then we leverage those funds with our revenue bonds to generate additional loan dollars. Historically, to date, each $1 of state funds has generated over $14 in construction funding and about $3 in interest savings for local governments. Our current 2013 intended use plan has 118 fundable projects totaling $205 million. The full PCA project list has 331 projects for about $1.3 billion. We also have allocated, the PFA allocated $88 million to capitalized non-point source loan programs, the AGBMP loan program, and the PCA's Clean Water Partnership loan program. Then we have the WIF program, which has been mentioned, the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program. These are supplemental assistance grants for high-cost projects focused on existing needs that provided either as a match to USDA rural development funding or packaged with our own Clean Water Revolving Fund loans. And there are affordability criteria that are used to determine the size of the grant. Loans or grants that are packaged with our loans, we use 1.4% of median household income as the threshold of when a project is eligible for grant funding. So when the O&M costs and the debt service costs exceed 1.4% of income, the city is eligible for WIF grants. For a city of kind of an average income in the state, that's about $45 to $50 a month in user charges for an average household that the city would have to be at before, and then above that, grant funds would start kicking in. So that's still a fairly high user charge level before the grants are available. The bottom of the page identifies.
And I will just note before you leave WIF, the 2012 bonding bill appropriated $15 million. All has now been awarded or reserved for 2012-13 construction projects. And as I visited with individual members, at least one said, well, if we have such a backlog, why don't we in one bonding bill, you know, have half the bill this? The point is you have some limitations in how much you can move in any given year. This year you thought that number might be $25 million, I think, that you could conceivably do in a year.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, the issue becomes readiness to proceed because we don't award funds until a project has done all the planning and design work, has taken construction bids, and is ready to start construction. And so there's all of these projects that are on the list are in various stages of readiness, and I'll talk more about that when we get to the spreadsheets. But that really becomes the key thing, is how many projects are actually ready to go at a point in time or in the foreseeable future. The bottom of the page illustrates the Clean Water Legacy Fund programs that the PFA administers. These are programs that were created, actually most of them before the actual Clean Water Legacy Act, all of them before the constitutional amendment was adopted. But these programs are all funded through that source of money now. They essentially provide some additional grant funding when cities are required to go over and above what they would otherwise have to do for wastewater treatment to meet a specific water quality goal. The TMDL grants are total maximum daily load, are studies that are done on a specific impaired water, and then those studies lead to various actions that need to be taken, and in the case of cities, they become requirements in their permit to provide additional levels of treatment. These grants are available then to help cities meet that 50% grants. Phosphorus reduction program is a similar thing, essentially providing greater levels of phosphorus treatment specifically. And the small community program, that's a little different. That focuses on very small unsewered communities, often with raw sewage, kind of straight pipe discharges that have been really difficult to deal with, and this program focuses on those. The governor has proposed in his budget $18 million for the TMDL grant program, $4 million for the small community program. We did not request any money for the phosphorus program. We have funds available for the current projects on the list. And we've also proposed some technical changes to these programs, try to make them work better, and those changes are currently under review by the governor's office. The note at the bottom of the page.
Clarify, is that cash as opposed to GO?
Those are amounts from the dedicated sales tax clean water dollars. That 18 and 4 million are from the dedicated funds. The note at the bottom of the page, all of these programs follow the PCA's project priority list, which ranks projects based on environmental and public health criteria. So all of our programs follow that same priority list, which makes the funding more predictable for local governments once they know where they're at on the list, and it also kind of facilitates the coordination and packaging of different funding sources for a particular project. On the back side of the page are other programs. Drinking Water Revolving Fund, which is in most ways a mirror image of the Clean Water Program, but for drinking water infrastructure projects. It's a newer fund and a smaller dollars, but it works the same way. In this case, it's the health department that sets the project priorities based on public health criteria. Transportation Revolving Loan Fund is a much smaller program that we partner with MnDOT on a variety of smaller transportation projects, often providing funding to a local government for their share of a larger project. You can see the 2012 loans to Albertville and Nisswa were both that type of project. And at the bottom of the page, Credit Enhancement Program. This program provides no direct funding for projects. It's basically a limited state guarantee of local GO bonds that are issued for specific purposes. And that state guarantee allows those small communities to receive a higher bond rating, one notch below the state's rating, and therefore they receive better interest rates on their bonds. The project purposes are limited to what you can see there for counties and then for cities, wastewater, drinking water, and stormwater. The next page gives a little history of the Clean Water Revolving Fund loans that have been made over the years. You can see the it started in 1990. Total to date, about $2.5 billion in loans. You can see the average interest rate of the loans and the average discount from market at the time those loans were made. And then for every loan that we do, we calculate an estimated interest savings that the community will achieve by using the revolving loan fund at a below market rate versus if they had financed themselves at a market rate. So a total interest savings over $600 million since the beginning of the program. Bottom part of the page shows how the loans have been.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
Yes.
You know, I'm looking at the by RDC region, and you've got the ask your on number 12 down there. How come the interest rate, and I see that that is the Met Council, all other regions, you know, they're 1.8, 2.6. Get to Met Council, it's 3.5. Is there an explanation why theirs is, you know, good three-quarters or 1% above?
All of the interest rate structure is set by rule, and essentially we give every borrower 1.5% below the AAA market rate. And then there are additional discounts for smaller communities that are based on the cost of the cost of the project relative to the median household income of the community. So essentially, the smaller and the poorer a city is, the lower interest rate they get. In the case of the Met Council, they get the 1.5% below AAA market, and that's been very beneficial for them. They've been a big borrower in the program, but they don't get those other additional affordability-based interest discounts.
Follow-up? No. Continue, please.
The back side of the page shows those same statistics for the Drinking Water Revolving Fund
Ward has a question.
Program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm looking at the RDC region region also, and you know, the rate that's provided, the average rate, does that relate to like the bonding rate that we can get right now,
Mr. Freeman?
Keep in mind, Madam Chair, Representative Ward, keep in mind the average rates here that are shown at the bottom of the page are the average for those regions over the 20-plus years of the program. And so, you know, as you can see at the top part of the page, in 1990, the average rate on our loans was 5%. So rates have come down a lot over the years, and the numbers that you see here are, so you can't really compare it directly to current rates because this is an average over 20 years.
I think your question was, does it connect to the rate on our GO bonds? Was that your
correct
question? It doesn't really relate. My understanding is this is a different structure than the traditional GO bond.
Madam Chair, that's right. In any one given year, our rates would relate to the state's GO rate because we're selling AAA rated debt, the PFA is, and then we're providing 1.5% below that to communities. So actually the loans that we're making to all communities are lower than the state's GO bonding rate.
So, Madam Chair, what's the rate right now that we can bond at right now?
Last bond sale was 2.05 for GO bonds.
for job-ready programs, right? For job-ready programs. And so I have one more question, please, Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
So as I'm, and this is really a great comparison for the whole state by region and then, you know, geographic. As I look at this chart, you know, to me it looks like, you know, Greater Minnesota, Real Minnesota has, you know, about 50% and Metro has about 50%. But then as I kind of draw a line in the middle of the state, it looks like it's significantly different for like the northern part of state appropriations versus the southern part of the state appropriations. Am I reading that correctly, testifier, or not? I mean, and can you tell why that is?
Mr. Freeman, regional equity?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure you can really draw too many conclusions from that. There's the projects themselves, of course, are, you know, to a large extent driven by where the population centers are. Bigger cities are going to have larger projects than smaller cities from on a dollar standpoint. And at the same time, the smaller cities will have the lower interest rates. And a lot of that has to do with infrastructure, water infrastructure in particular, in small communities is very expensive compared to larger communities, even medium-sized communities, just simply because they don't have the number of households to spread the costs over. So in the metro area, average households in the Twin Cities metropolitan area are paying something around $20 a month. That's both the treatment costs to the Met Council for their treatment plants as well as the cost for the local city to maintain the sewer collection system. In small communities around the state, the numbers I mentioned, $40 to $50 a month even to trigger the WIF grants, are very common, and it's not at all unusual to see costs $60, $70, $80 a month or more per household. And it really comes down to that issue of the size and the scale of economy of scale that larger cities have versus the smaller communities.
And we could maybe revisit that near the end of this presentation again, because I think it's the question we always ask and want to be assured about, and so maybe after the presentation we'll come back and take another look at that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, as I mentioned, the drinking water program shows those same statistics on the back side of that sheet. And then the next page shows two bar charts that illustrate the leveraging that we're able to do with the revolving loan funds from the federal and state dollars that have been received. So what you see is for the last 10 years or so, the green bars are the project, the loans that we've made. The blue bars are the federal dollars that we've received, and the red is the state match that has come in. So you can just get a picture of the leveraging and kind of the bang for the buck, if you will, of the amount of money that the state and federal has put in and the loans that we've been able to generate from that. Then the next page, we get to the green set of spreadsheets, and the green are the clean water loan program, and the blue at later in the packet are the drinking water program. There is a couple of white sheets kind of in between there, which is an alphabetical listing if you're interested in looking for a particular project. This is the entire 2013 project priority list as it's ranked by the Pollution Control Agency through their environmental criteria that are point criteria that are spelled out in their rules. These projects are in all different stages of readiness. Generally, this is a five-year list of projects. I think the total is about $1.4 billion. Some projects are just starting the planning process. Some are ready for construction or already in construction. the shaded lines, when there's a shaded line all the way across, it means that project is funded and it's now under construction. Some of the programs have different milestones and different criteria established, the WIF program in particular, where funds are reserved when a project reaches a specific milestone. Either they've submitted the plans and specs and gotten approval on those, or, as I mentioned, we also use this program to partner with USDA Rural Development, and when they make a funding commitment, they follow these same priorities, and when they make a funding commitment and WIF funds are available, then we can reserve the WIF match. And so when you see just one cell that's shaded, that's what that indicates.
And members, when we see these staggering costs, we have sometimes wondered, isn't there by now some sort of breakthrough in new technology that brings down the cost of this? Are they doing it differently in other parts of the world? Have they figured something else out? I mean, it is overwhelming to see these costs and then imagine a very small population base. That,
yes, and Madam Chair, a couple comments to that. One is that I can remember for a number of years, Terry and I would bring these sheets before you, and there were $2 billion, $2.1 billion, I think $2.2 billion at one point in need. So we're now down to $1.3, $1.4. There's been a lot of progress. Some of that, I think, maybe given the PCA is sort of doing a better job of sort of focusing on what are the real projects versus there used to be some things here that maybe weren't exactly real projects. Pipe dreams, if you will. And the other point is that in terms of technology, there actually has been a lot of, I mean, there's no black box magic that makes wastewater disappear, you know, very easily and cheaply. It is expensive. But one thing that we found, one example, phosphorus treatment. When 10 years ago or more, as the Pollution Control Agency and others were getting more and more concerned about phosphorus and the impact on the environment and started looking at ratcheting down treatment requirements for cities to treat phosphorus to much lower levels than they were before. Initially, the cost estimates of doing that were huge, because it would require a lot of capital equipment to meet those higher stringent limits. As time went on, the engineers kind of figured out a process that they call BioP, and I don't want to try to really get into the details of that because that's not my thing. But what I do know is that they were able to take a lot of the existing infrastructure, and by changing the treatment process a little bit and pumping more oxygen in and doing some other things, they were able to greatly increase the phosphorus treatment that they could get out of more conventional treatment technology and brought the cost down tremendously. So that's one example where there are those things that have happened.
Representative Earhart has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are all of these bonding monies or are some of them monies out of the legacy funds? And two, are they all loans or are some of them grants, outright grants?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative, most of the financing that we provide is low-interest loans. The vast majority is loans. And those loans are supported by some federal dollars and then a 20% state match. But as that bar chart that we just passed over illustrates, our funding level is much beyond what those federal and state equity contributions are because we've got all the repayments coming back in and we can leverage that revenue stream. So it's mostly loans supported by a small amount of state bonding for the loan program. The WIF grant program for the hardship grants, that is from state bond dollars.
Continue.
Madam Chair, so I'll just kind of quickly, this spreadsheet kind of going across, you see the rank and the points in the project description, then you see the estimated project cost. That's the total project cost that the community has identified for their project. In some cases, you'll see a blank there, which means really the project isn't far enough in the planning to even kind of have a realistic cost. So there are some of those. The next column over, it says CWRF loan 2013 IUP fundable range. Those are projects that are on our current loan project list. They've completed all the planning work. They're in the process of doing their design, and they're eligible. They've requested to be put on our 2013 loan project list. So the projects with dollars in that column are essentially ready to go or moving towards readiness. They're working on the design right now.
And so, members, in all of these instances, it does require something of local government. And it's so complex. Whenever you come to us, we send you directly to the agency. They are very helpful in sorting this through. But you will often find that perhaps a local government hasn't completed a particular stage of paperwork that has to be done, or that, you know, that there's some delay there. So the agency is very responsive to your questions if you're having a question about one of your projects. Representative Mahoney.
So as we look at that on the page 8, you have, I'm looking at the blue sheets, is that correct?
Well, I was talking about the green, but I can...
We're still on the green.
Okay, then I'll...
Okay.
The green.
I'll speed up so we can get through this. I won't spend a lot of detail, but I'll just quickly identify what those columns are. The next one over, CWRF principal forgiveness. Since the federal era stimulus bill in 2009, the federal money has had a requirement that part of it be provided as grant that's packaged with the loan. For whatever reason, they can't bring themselves to use the word grant, so they call it principal forgiveness, and that's, but it's essentially it's grant money. When at the time we make the loan, part of that principal of the loan is forgiven up front. It's not principal that's forgiven on a loan that was made previously. And then you can see some columns for the WIF program. WIF grant funds awarded a reserve from prior funds prior to the 2012 bonding bill. And then you can see also a column for the 2012 WIF appropriation. That was $15 million. All that money has been awarded or committed, and you can see on that column where that money has gone. And then you see the WIF grant estimated need. That is based on the preliminary information we have from cities and running it through the formula, the 1.4% of median income, or in the case of projects that are working with rural development, we use their affordability criteria, and the WIF can do 65% of that. So that's what that estimated grant need is there, but keep in mind that not all of those projects are ready to go this year. So as you get further through the process, we can, and we're right now talking to communities and making sure we've got up-to-date information about who's working on design documents and will be ready to go in the spring, and so we're working on kind of narrowing that down right now.
But the number you were thinking roughly right now is $25
million? In the past, that's been in the range of appropriations for the program, and the money tends to go pretty quickly, but we'll have a better sense of that in the future. Then you can see...
Yeah, could I ask a question? If it's blank, then does that simply mean that the project isn't far enough along to determine the need?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the blank in the WIF column most likely means that it doesn't meet the affordability criteria to need a WIF loan or a WIF grant. So the loan by itself is adequate funding for the project. So those blanks, in most cases, that's what it refers to, is it doesn't trigger a WIF grant based on the affordability criteria.
Okay, thank you.
You can see then the Clean Water Legacy programs and for the TMDL grants and the phosphorus grants, you can see the cities that have applied for those grants. Again, we don't make the award until the project goes to construction. So we've got a lot of applications specifically on TMDL grants, and those funds are available, but we'll wait for the, and in a lot of cases, those funds will be packaged with our own Clean Water Revolving Fund loans, or in some cases, packaged with rural development funding. So as the money's available, and cities are now working through that, basically the design process to be ready to go with their project. There's two columns for the small community program, TA technical assistance grants, and then construction grants and loans. As I mentioned, this is the program that focuses on very small unsewered communities. Most of these communities are less than 50 households. In a lot of cases, they're less than 30 households. In some cases, they're even much smaller than that, and I'm sure many of you are aware of those kind of really small little places in your districts. In some cases, and the ones that rank really high on this priority list are in this situation where there's raw sewage discharges to surface water, obviously a really serious public health problem that we've got to deal with, but they're really tough to deal with because they're so small, and typically the lots are too small for an adequate individual septic system. We try to work with them actually to, when possible, the best way to address these is each private homeowner builds a complying septic system and it stays privately owned, and that's in just about all cases that would be the preferred solution if it could be done. But in many of these, the lots are too small, the soils are bad, the groundwater is high, and it's just not possible. And so they're trying to look for some other small scale solutions, and it takes some time, and the technical assistance money helps them do that. And then you see the other funders, USDA Rural Development, who I mentioned several times, are kind of our main partner. There's also the DEED Small Cities Development Program. That's they get HUD block grant money, and a certain amount of that is dedicated to infrastructure for small communities, and so we do partner with them.
So Small Cities Development Program means it's connected to some local economic development project?
Madam Chair, not always. They have different categories of funding. A lot of their money goes for housing rehab. I think some of it goes for some more direct economic development, but most of it is housing rehab or public infrastructure. And then you can see there are some other funding sources, too, that occasionally get packaged in, a community can access for one reason or another. So that's the complicated one. And then a few pages beyond the blue sheets then show the drinking water
priority
list.
And the white sheets, you said, were simply alphabetizing what was on the green sheets if you wanted to quickly.
Correct. The alphabetical list, if you're looking for a particular community, you can look it up, and the PPL rank column will then, you can go back to the green sheets and find that community from that.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Freeman, in reference to the ranking, usually you give us a number that you likely will get down to. What number would that be for the green sheets?
Yes, Representative Hausman, Chair Hausman, Representative Erdahl, thank you for bringing that up. I forgot to mention that. Our loan program does not have capacity to fund all of the projects on the green sheet, and so we follow that priority list, and for the past several years, we've set the fundable range at 45 points. And so as you're looking at the list, 45 points comes in about the middle of page 5 of 7. So projects with 45 points or above. I'm looking at the green. I'm sorry. The 45 points relates to the clean water ranking system. So projects with 45 points or above on the green sheet, they can be, and we work hard to maintain consistency with that cutoff from year to year. It does depend somewhat on the volume of loan demand versus the funding available, but we're able to use the bonding that we do to kind of level that out, and so 45 points has been the consistent cutoff for several years. Cities know that if they're above that level, they're investing their own money in the engineering and the planning to get ready, and they can be fairly confident that at least the loan program will be available to them when their project is ready to go. The projects that are ranked lower, we make sure rural development is aware of those and works with those. There's also, as I mentioned before, the credit enhancement program that can help communities do some of their own local funding for these. And there's otherwise, their cities just finance them on their own in some cases as well.
Madam Chair, thank you for your presentation. Just kind of, that's kind of where I was going. You kind of alluded to it towards the end of what you just said, but looking at cities that are below that 45 point mark, you know, what are the things beyond that, working with rural development, that do you do with those smaller towns to get them moved up that point list, or what?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative, there are some things that a community can do to work, get higher on the list, although a lot of cases not. The ones that can, unsewered areas, the priority ranking is one of the major factors is the density of the area, and so sometimes a township or a county or a lake association kind of originally proposes a project that's sewering the whole lake, or in some cases a couple lakes run together, and because it's such a large area with a relatively small number of households, it doesn't score very well when they do that. And so we really try to work with them and encourage them to focus in on the smaller areas where there's some really problems with failing septics, and sort of by zeroing in on a smaller area, the priority of the priority points tend to go up. So that's one thing. Other communities, sometimes they're planning a project, but the ranking a lot of times depends on if a system is at capacity or has some of these additional treatment requirements related to a TMDL or something. Sometimes communities' points may change as time goes on and those things become more apparent, but a lot of times not. So cities below this level, really that's where we encourage rural development to use a lot of their funding. And then in some cases, it just may be the community needs to look at funding that themselves, and the credit enhancement program does provide some assistance in terms of a lower interest rate to help them do that.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you ever seen a city that had a centralized sewer system or centralized water system that have gotten to the point where these tools maybe haven't worked, where they've kind of gone the other direction to individual type septic systems, or has that occurred within your...
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm trying to think if I can think of an example where somebody went from centralized to decentralized, and off the top of my head, I can't. Typically, and that's one thing that we, when unsewered communities come into the program and want to build a centralized system, one of our messages is, you know, you really have to make sure this is what you want to do and what the citizens are prepared to do, because once you build that, you have it and you're responsible for it essentially forever, in perpetuity is the language of the Clean Water Act. So we do try to make sure cities think real hard about, do they want to go that direction, or are there some other privately owned options that they want to explore more?
Further? Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Freeman, we've been hearing a lot about climate change and how the extreme climate happenings are changing projects, you know, in around the state of Minnesota, capital investment projects or any of them, period. So how, you know, and I think we're going to even hear a bill that from Representative Gunther about, you know, a flood that occurred in his area that changed some facilities that he has. So how flexible, or let's say we have a disaster in an area, how flexible or how would that play an impact in changing maybe the points or ranking of a area? Does it or doesn't it?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, for the most part, it does not. The projects on this list are essentially long-term capital improvements that communities, they're responsible for the infrastructure. They plan for various improvements, and there's sometimes requirements for various improvements over time. But this program does not react well to emergency situations. The lead-in time is just, as much as we've tried to streamline it, it can't turn around that quickly. We did with the last flood event, the Public Facilities Authority did receive $6 million to, totally separate from any of this, for some water infrastructure repair replacement projects related to the flood, and so that's a separate thing. It doesn't really factor into these programs. Now, one thing I will say, however, is in terms of the type of projects and how cities plan for these projects, there is a lot of discussion about, for example, the drought situation in many parts of the state and the impact on groundwater, and of course, in most cases, these projects and the standard way of dealing with wastewater is you treat it and then you discharge it to a surface water and it flows downstream, which in most cases eventually it flows out of the state. There is a lot of discussion about are there ways to reuse that wastewater for that treated wastewater for various industrial processes or other things. And I was just at a meeting at the PCA, Pollution Control Agency, yesterday talking about, are there things that we can do with these programs? Are there other things that can be done to both help and encourage cities to look at, and in industries for that matter, to look at kind of how we can reuse wastewater? I think as we kind of the drought situation persists, the wastewater becomes more of a valuable asset that we need to maybe look more closely at instead of just flushing it downstream.
And members, Deb Dyson has put together sort of a comprehensive list of both flood mitigation dollars and disaster relief, some of which is geobonding, sort of as a follow-up to our weather-related impact on infrastructure issues, and I think we're probably going to try to get Kent Lockesmore or somebody in, and we'll distribute the sheets that she's put together just to give you a sense. There's a lot of dollars there to give you some history about that, and in a sense, it relates to our the bill we're going to hear too. So, we have Representative Earhart.
I have another question for you, Madam Chair. You just were talking, flood mitigation is not in this pot of money, is it?
It is not.
Okay. Well, here's my question. What's your annual or biannual, however you calculate it, amount of loans and grants that you handle on a yearly basis, biannual, whatever?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative, last year in fiscal year 2012, the total grants and loans from all of our programs, I believe, was $239 million. I thought I used to have, well, of course, I can, the Clean Water Loan Fund, the chart in the packet shows that the Clean Water Loans in 2012 were $132 million. Drinking water was $42 million. So the loans themselves were about $174-175 million, and then $50 or $60 million in grants of various forms.
Madam Chair,
Senator Hart.
This is a these are all revolving, aren't they? I mean, so you get that money back?
The loans are, yes.
So I'll call it leakage. You have costs of administration and so forth. But is that loan fund then growing just on its own basis, even though there's no new money in it?
Mr. Freeman.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, the loan fund revolves, and this is under federal law, the repayments have to come back into the fund. You can't do anything else with them. And so currently, and we kind of do some financial models to look at what's the capacity of the loan fund. Currently, the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund, if there was no new money put in, federal or state, it just survived on the existing equity, we would be able to do about $100 million a year in perpetuity. As you go on, that's just kind of in constant dollars. So that $100 million is going to buy you less and less as you go on. But that's the capacity of the fund right now. And so we have, if you look at this sheet, we have for many years, most years of the past 10, been funding in excess of that $100 million, which means, you know, we need to keep getting the additional state and federal dollars to support those larger lending levels. And those have the benefit of both we can lend more right now, but it also builds the capacity of the fund for the future. So that $100 million will slowly rise as we go forward.
Madam Chair, then your efforts are because they're aging infrastructure and so forth, and so you're trying to keep up with new discoveries and what we already know is happening, or new requests?
Is that yes, city, I mean, and it's the city's come to us with their requests. They do their capital improvement plans, and they know what kinds of infrastructure rehab, and this, I don't have to tell the Capital Investment Committee, but I'll mention it anyway. It's just water infrastructure, just like roads and bridges and everything else, it wears out over time. And so eventually you have to do some rehab work and some replacement, as well as the new standards that come into play. So it all adds up.
Representative Mahoney, and then I think we'll ask you to conclude so we have time for our bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments yesterday in Ways and Means generated an awful lot of emails and phone calls over the evening, so I'm going to be careful how I say any questions from now on or comments.
It does happen, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how many people that buy $40 and $50 bottles of wine can complain.
How about a box?
I have two questions, actually. When you say no, have any towns actually died? Have they just disappeared off the map because of the inability to do their sewer and water?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney.
You're 25 years at this.
I think over time, we certainly have seen small communities have come pretty close to dying. At some point, you know, I guess you could ask, is at what point do you continue to improve infrastructure. But that's really a local decision in our mind. What we try to do is show what are the costs going to be if you go ahead with this project, how much is it going to cost per household, for how many years, what are you going to have to raise your rates to, et cetera. And, you know, if a community can show us that they're willing to, and we not only look to the council, but we look to, you know, have you had public meetings? Has it been in the newspaper? Are people aware of this project? And we do, you know, if a community is ready to proceed with a big project, we'll typically we fund it, but we may delay funding it while they put the necessary rate increases in place or do other steps to make sure that the financing is in place to pay back the loan.
Representative Moline may have something to add to this point.
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I just wanted to add, I mean, I think a lot has been said between Representative Erdahl and I about the actual impact it can have on communities to fund such things such as wastewater treatment plants. But just, you know, back to my region specifically, I mean, I guess you could, there's different definitions of what could be considered a dying community. But in my community where there is currently construction moratorium until the new wastewater treatment plant is completed, it has had a significant economic impact on our region. For example, in Chisholm, there is a drill manufacturing company. It's one of only four left in the United States. Prior to the year 2000, there was over 24 manufacturers in the United States that manufactured drill for your electric power, or drill bits for your electric power drills, and those have all gone overseas, except there's only four left in the country, and one of them is in Chisholm. And they provide lots of good living wage jobs, and they actually want to be able to expand their business, expand their manufacturing business in Chisholm, and have been unable to do so because of this construction moratorium. And so once the new wastewater treatment plant is completed, they will actually be able to expand their business in Chisholm, and will be one of the four manufacturing businesses left in the country that's making that particular product. So I think that's just one example of the importance that these wastewater treatment plants can have to our region, and especially to jobs and economic development. So, you know, I think there can be, I guess, different measures of what could be considered a dying community or not, but I think that making sure we invest in greater Minnesota and make sure that companies who want to expand in our state are able to do so and have the appropriate infrastructure to do so. And I know that the PFA has been very vital to that effort.
Madam Chair. And I'm not trying to pick on a city the size of Chisholm. I think my comments were trying to get at cities with, and you alluded to it, where there is 15, 20, 25, 30 households. And that's where I was trying to go. I do know that years ago when the PFA was in the Jobs Committee, there was a bit of a conversation, and I was just trying to find on that. So I'm going to go to my next question because, again, I'm always worried about who's going to call me about $40 bottles of wine. What have you done in terms of, or are you looking at financing gray water systems when a town decides that it doesn't want to waste that kind of water? I mean, and a gray water system is entirely different than fresh water or sewer.
And I should say we have only about four more minutes on this because we want to save the last 15 minutes for
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I am familiar with the gray water systems. I think in other parts of the state or other parts of the country, that's becoming a more and more common way of dealing with the volume of water that comes from washing machines and things like that. You know, we really look to the regulatory agencies for guidance and priority setting as far as what projects should be funded. I know, and I don't know the details. I know there's some issues, I believe, with plumbing code related to gray water systems. I don't know what those issues are. I haven't seen any communities come to us with a proposal to finance a gray water system, but we would look to the health department really for both the priority and the regulatory eligibility of those kind of projects.
Representative Erdl, to this point?
Not exactly. It's just a real quick question. Okay. When you get to the cutoff point on the drinking water, far as the ranking.
All right. We'll recognize.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdl, the cutoff point on
the... So, concluding on the blue sheets.
The blue sheets, the cutoff point is 10 points, and it's a whole... The scale that the health department uses for ranking the drinking water projects is a whole different scale, so... It doesn't relate at all to on the clean water side. It goes up to 100, a little over 100, and we've set the bar at 45. On the drinking water side, the highest points go up to, I think, high 30s or 40. 43 is the highest. We're able to set the cutoff right now at 10 points. We have been able to move that down a little bit. When there was a large volume of projects a few years ago, I think that cutoff was as high as 12. We've stretched that down to 10 because of the fund capacity relative to the demand for loans. So the majority of the projects on the clean water list we are able to provide funding to at this point.
Does that conclude your presentation? Representative Erdl?
Yes, that's all. Thank you.
Okay. So, any further? You concluded your presentation, and there are no further questions on this. Then we're going to move to the bill, and this bill is not in our possession, but it shows the complications of particular local issues, and really in some ways this is also going to relate to our presentation when we get to the whole issue of disaster relief and what happens when something falls between the cracks. And so we're welcoming Monty Roman. Have I got that?
Thank you.
Correct. And we'll recognize Representative Gunther first.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's a pleasure to be the first proposal, at least, before this committee. And I just want to remind everybody, remember this when final judgment comes. This is a good project. Truman, in 2010, had 14 inches of rain. And they had just finished, PFA had given them money for a trench and a 60-inch pipe that covered part of the community. And I think we passed these out. You can see where the trench is. And then they went and they looked at where the basements were filling up with water. And they found out...
After the flood.
After the flood. And you can see that in this red sheet right here. And you can see where the two remains that were... storm sewer mains that we're proposing will drain that water. And you can also see that's a street that acts as a barrier for water from the east side coming into the, from the west side coming into the east.
So just to clarify the timing, you had a PFA project and then the flood.
Then the flood.
Is that the order?
And we knew that the PFA project we had was going to take care of one-third of the problem, one-third of the city. We had bigger rain events that would cause water to go into basements, but never to the extent that we had 80% of the basements filled full of water. And our problem was we were kind of caught in the middle in Truman. If the water didn't go on the kitchen floor, our problem was we were kind of caught in the middle in Truman. If the water didn't go on the kitchen floor, if it just went up to the floor joists, FEMA did not consider that a problem. So consequently, there was no flood relief unless it went up into the kitchen. It didn't care if you took care of the furnace, the hot water heater, all the stuff that people have in basements now. That can be destroyed completely. FEMA did not recognize that. Consequently, TFA could not do a whole lot about it because they were hamstrung. So we were stuck in the middle, and what the flood did is it hurt the storm sewer systems that we had, even though they were at present not adequate. So now when we have a 2-inch rain, we have backup in basements, and there's a little crossover, so you can imagine what the basements smell like. And it's not a good situation. Insurance companies will no longer insure homes in Truman, and people can't wait to get out. And it was a very viable community. Dave Jennings, former representative, that was his hometown. And I think it's time that we fix the problem by putting money in to match Truman's money for completing a storm sewer system for Truman. And we fix what FEMA didn't choose to fix and what PFA couldn't fix and get Truman out of the middle. this is the reason we're here. We're asking for 100, I'm going to amend that, have an oral amendment to make that 125, $1.25 million to $1.35 million because they had new figures. That'll be half. Truman's going to match that. Truman's presently $800,000 in the hole. It's a small community that, in the last census, shrunk by 50 people. It's, what's the population?
1115.
And we want to make it a viable community so it will grow by the next census. And you got to remember the Fairmont Community Hospital, 60% of the patients are on Medicaid or Medicare, so it's not a very rich area, although it's got very great farmland. And I've looked at the census of people in Martin County that are in the upper income brackets according to the governor's tax plan. There's 116 of them, which is more than the rest of my district put together. So,
Mr. Romans, we'll ask you to...
Yeah, Representative Gunther hit a lot of the high points, but I just want to thank you for allowing me to talk today. Truman is a city of about 1,115 residents located in Martin County in south central Minnesota with a totally agricultural-based economy. Our community was at ground zero during that September flood where we received the 14 inches of rain in about a 24-hour period. Like he said, over 80% of our homes were damaged with basement flooding. Governor Plenty visited our community the day following the flood to see firsthand the devastation. He called you all into a special session for legislation to help us out in the flooded area. They graciously gave us 25% of the public infrastructure damage and public cleanup costs that were incurred in the presidential funding area. But FEMA came along and funded the other 75% of that damage, which was just the public cost for cleanup and our infrastructure damage from police and fire type things. But our residents weren't so lucky. As Representative Gunther told you, FEMA was able to help us out there. So a lot of people that didn't have any insurance at all had to fund their cleanup costs themselves. And also those that did have insurance, a lot of them were cut off from their insurance coverage because of that damage. We talked about the maps there, and we've also suffered other major flooding events in 93 and 2005 with some larger rainfalls of 4 to 5 inches that have caused a tremendous amount of damage too. And on those maps, you can see a lot of the infrastructure is undersized. We did work with Martin County in 2009 for phase one of our project, and Martin County and Truman received a larger loan from PFA, which our share is over $400,000. We're paying that back each year. And then also right before the flood, we got approval to do phase two, which was another $400,000 to put that 60-inch interceptor line up to that red area there. And we're very gracious and thankful to PFA for the help they've given us. But the third phase of the project is once you get into the streets of the project, are very expensive, and that's about a $2.7 million project. And that's where our citizens are going to have a real big trouble funding this project. We did set up a new stormwater utility fund. That's we raised some funds there, and also through a tax levy. But we're kind of at the max right now, and this project is just too big for our community to handle by itself. And So we're asking for your help on the third phase here, which is a very expensive part of this project, which we feel will get in those areas, those pockets in red that our engineer drew those up during the flood. They came down and drew out all those red areas. They actually went around and designed that right during when the water was sitting in Truman that day after the flood. So it shows you that those pipes will get into those areas that are beyond those yellow areas. And that yellow area there, those yellow lines, Main Street is right down the middle of town. It's a high area. It's a county highway. And the yellow areas are old railroad tracks. So it kind of cuts the town into quadrants. And that water just can't get to that southeast corner to drain out of town. So those larger pipes help feed that water under those two, I call them dikes or berms. But it's very important that we get those larger 42-inch lines under those areas to bring that water faster. Otherwise, it ponds and causes tremendous amount of damage. So I guess I just wanted to thank you for your time and would hope that you could help us out in any way possible. We really need help, and our citizens, small town guys, just can't afford this on our own. So that's kind of where we're at.
We have four questions. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gunn, you said backup. Now, usually when we think of backup, it's sewer backup, or was it infiltration?
Who would like to handle it? Mr. Roman?
Madam Chair and Representative, a lot of it is backup, and this project also separates the two. It starts in the lower end of the red there. It actually lowers the sanitary sewer down. A lot of towns back in the 50s and 40s were built with the kind of, they were all intertwined with the storm sewer and the sanitary. So our project would actually lower the sanitary would be lowered below the storm sewer, so they'd actually be in, so when they do cross, they're not crossing through each other, they're crossing, and we get rid of a lot of cross connections. We found a few of those cross connections in our other projects too, but it's actually part of the system is to lower the sanitary sewer too, to get those two apart, because some of it also is from cross connections and there, when the storm sewer surges from total pressure, it does back up in the sanitary, and that causes the basements to back up. So this project does separate those two too.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Roman, is it the Truman Blue Jays?
Yes, it is.
Blue Jays. Yeah. Okay. I was in Truman the day that those rains came. And Truman's a beautiful city, but it's quite flat. It'd be a great city to door knock in because it's flat. It's a great city. But was the school, Mr. Roman, was the school hit? That's in the southern part of town. Was
right.
That hit at all by those floods?
Mr. Roman.
Madam Chair, Representative. The school is located toward the southeast corner there, and the parking lot and the football field were all flooded. The school was just a little bit high enough to not sustain any damage. They did cancel school for 2 days. And the kids were outstanding. They came and sandbagged and everything else. They were there to help, but they could have gone home and played games. But the school itself did not get damaged. But the football field, we had to cancel the last two football games and play them at a visiting field someplace because we had contamination on the football field from the flooding. The football field was underwater. The baseball field underwater. It was that southeast part of town is where the school is at. Yes, and it water all ran around it. But the parking lot was about half full of water too. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Mr. Rowan, the nursing home, was that hit at all by the flood? Because I know if you go up Highway 15, it was just like, you know, lakes on both sides.
Right.
Madam Chair, he seems to know a lot about Truman. Were you selling something there?
Yeah. I was serving people in the community.
Is there a golf course nearby?
Yeah, a real nice one right down
here. Mr. Roman,
Madam Chair, the nursing home sits up in that northeast part of town there, and there was water around the area. A lot of that red area is around the nursing home, but it never got into the nursing home. But we were lucky there. No, it did not get damaged.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Roman, so phases one and two are done, and so you're looking at three here.
Right.
Was Louisville hit at all?
Mr. Roman?
They didn't have quite, you might know more about Louisville, I guess.
Yeah, Louisville was hit.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My sympathies to your community and the people that were hit. We've had floods in southern Minnesota as well, and many of our communities don't get the FEMA designation, or the businesses do, but not the homes, and there's a lot of pain inflicted. And I guess I'm certainly supportive of doing something, but I just want to kind of piggyback on what I heard Representative Ward say earlier, which is, these type of projects are going to be more frequent as we see changes in our environment, and it's and what's happening. We've watched it year after year down in our part of the state. And so to Mr. Freeman, it seems to me that perhaps the scoring needs to change, the point system needs to change, something needs to change in order to proactively view potential harm to a community in a way that might move some of these projects up if need be. I don't know. I guess I'm just, Representative Ward's comments rang true, and the testimony we're hearing is devastating to communities, and is there something we can do proactively in your approval system to help move some of these ahead faster so we're not dealing with it after the fact but ahead?
And as opposed to wastewater infrastructure, right now we're only talking about stormwater. Is that correct, Mr. Yep. Freeman? I think that's sort of... That would be,
Madam Chair, Representative. That's correct, and that becomes the problem. Is that Truman's and we did fund the two projects in Truman because our wastewater and stormwater, you know, are related and sometimes come together. And we did fund two projects that where there were sanitary sewer focused projects that eliminated some of the cross connections with the storm sewer system and did some other things to improve the sanitary sewer. But the program, it's not a matter of priority, it's the eligibility requirements for the program, which really kind of come out of the Clean Water Act and EPA that oversees the program, which is focused really primarily on wastewater and water quality. So a project that's specifically storm sewer related falls outside of our eligibility.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm new to this committee, so I have a lot to learn, so thank you for allowing my
but
question.
Representative Norton, I think your question is going to connect to the next hearing when we I don't know if Kent Lacasmo is the one who's going to present that, but when we look at what we've done in flood hazard mitigation and disaster relief and where are the gaps, because what they're pointing out, I think, is a gap. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was tempted to ask Representative Davids if he had a wrestling match on that school, or in that school gymnasium. You know, when we have site visits, he points out where he's had a wrestling match, but he never tells us whether he won or lost. He also has a variety of caps that he used to wear on the tax committee periodically, and I don't know if he has a Blue Jay cap or not, but he doesn't need to comment. I have a serious question.
I've never won in Truman, Madam Chair.
My serious question, I think we got close to it, if there are other communities in that region that experienced that same kind of storm, what was it, 13 or 14 inches, and then will they be coming forward with a request as well if they're in the same situation?
Who might know? Representative Gunther?
I represented a good share of those communities you're talking about, and they have sufficient storm sewer problems that just that quantity of rain in that short period of time overflew. Everything was loaded up. In fact, there was one community in my district I couldn't even get to. There's no way I could get in a town of Odin.
But I think the question is what you're saying is that wasn't a one-time event in Truman, that now in Truman for every 2 inch, is that what I heard? That's why, my sense is what the question is that an ongoing problem in every town, that their stormwater system?
Madam Chairman, Representative Carlson, it isn't a problem except in Truman with a 3 or 4 or 5 inch rain problem. There might be some damp water in basements, but not to the degree that they have in Truman.
So yeah, it seems to be unique to Truman.
That was essentially, Madam Chair, the question is this unique to Truman, or are other communities going to have the same issue and come before us? But thank you.
Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This shaded red looks like there's a lake, flowage or something. We've got arrows going here, water coming in here. Is this lowlands, or is there a lake in here, or what is there? And the second thing is you've got wastewater flowing into an open ditch here, if I'm reading this right.
Mr. Roman.
Madam Chair, Representative, Truman does not have any lakes or streams in town. There's 5,200 acres of farmland that drain north northeast. We're at the bottom end of a 5,000-acre watershed. So a lot of that water coming in from the south is from farmland that the water just drains into Truman. So and the sanitary sewer is we have a wastewater plant straight east of town, about a mile, and it's probably sanitary sewer pipes and so on. That's treated, and we've received state awards for that. So the sanitary sewer itself is fine. That ditch only covers or carries stormwater. So no, sanitary sewer goes the same, almost the same route, but it's in a force main that's sealed and goes to the wastewater plant. So, but there are no lakes or streams in Truman, no.
Sir David?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've noticed as kind of a theme in this committee where we're talking about a project needs to be done because of severe weather resiliency or things like that. I think we need to be a little bit careful on that because actually as far as extreme weather events for large rainfalls, things such as that, tornadoes, frequency is actually down. So I don't know if we want to be predicating and selling everything we do in this committee based upon extreme weather resiliency when actually frequency in many cases is down. We just have situations where if you get 14 inches of rain on flat land, it's going to flood. That's just the way it is. And the 14 inches of rain isn't because of some whatever. It's because there's 14 inches of rain. And actually, as I said, if you look throughout history, frequency is down on some of these major events. So I hope we're not trying to sell everything on these projects. I mean, this project needs to be done, not because of extreme weather resiliency, but because Truman's a beautiful city. It happens to be flat, and if you get 14 inches of rain, there's going to be puddles in the streets.
I think Representative Gunther is not trying to make that argument.
No, but I'm hearing that, Madam Chair, around the table from Representative Norton and Ward. I just don't want to listen every time we have a project. It's because of climate change.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, my question, you don't have any lakes or streams. When you've treated your water and gotten the awards, where does it go? And have you incorporated holding ponds or something along that lines into this whole system?
Mr. Roman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, our sanitary sewer water, once it's treated, goes into that same ditch afterwards, after it's treated. But we've discussed, holding ponds and so on. They come with a severe cost, too, and our engineers have looked at that. I don't have a cost for you, but we have looked at trying to store some of that water, too, but that's a large cost, too.
Representative Mahoney?
Well, there should be some kind of a program out there somewhere that helps you try to do environmentally experimental programs that might return water to that southwestern aquifer down there. But, I'm sure you'll find them if they're out there.
And one final question, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Mahoney's point, just to follow on to that, is the open ditch connected to a county ditch or to some type of a downstream, the water's got to go someplace, so where does it go? And is there a domino effect of other communities to the east of that are going to be impacted by you pushing water to the east?
Madam Chair, Representative, our ditch connects onto an unnamed ditch, that kind of a farm ditch, and eventually flows to Perch Creek and then to the Blue Earth River and eventually to the Minnesota River. It does flow northeast, comes toward Mankato and eventually toward the cities wherever that water goes, but it does follow a system. And we've had, before we put the ditch in, we had many meetings with the farmers downstream. They had concerns, and we addressed those concerns, but it does eventually flow northeast into the Perch Creek and then to the Blue Earth River into Minnesota. So it does follow the path, and eventually, I'm sure it gets down to New Orleans sometime. But
Madam Chairman, the Red River Valley is not the only place where water flows north of Minnesota.
Representative Earhart, did you have one more question?
Well, I had a question for you, Madam Chair. I thought I heard your team of scientists that we've listened to say that these occurrences were happening more frequently. And I don't know what's going on in southeast Minnesota, but they were concerned that not only the whole state, but the whole United States was having more frequent disruptions than the normal, what we consider normal. So I just want to make sure that your town is on the alert you may be next in line.
Madam Chair.
So if our committee administrator tells us we need to vacate the room, but if we have the opportunity, Representative Davids and Representative Earhart could engage in a debate at the table.
Madam Chair, I'll bring in scientists that say just the opposite. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Members, one announcement. There are 2 days, if you're just looking ahead, we will not be having a meeting. We're not having a meeting on February 7 and on February 19. We'll get that out to you via email, too, but just in case you were looking for spots that you might schedule something else, those are 2 days we will not be meeting. Meeting is adjourned.